Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable Absolutely. Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning and welcome to another episode of What's Next. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. Today, we hear from our Action City Buffaloes, Lathan Jones, and Buffalo State University professor John Torrey. They sit with Nyla Ansari Cotillo. But first, Jay Moran speaks with Jennifer Rizzo Choi, executive director of the International Institute of Buffalo. She shares insight on how the presidential determination shapes refugee resettlement across the country and here in Western New York. Rizzo Choi explains how refugee ceilings have shifted dramatically over the years, from 220,000 during the Reagan era to 125,000 under the Biden administration, and how those changes affect local agencies like hers. She also highlights the economic contributions refugees make, including a $124 billion boost in net worth over 15 years, even as funding cuts have forced the Institute to scale back from 65 to 33 employees. And she also looks ahead to the upcoming Refugee Comedy Fundraiser on October 15th, an event celebrating resilience, culture, and community support.
Thanks for coming back. We've really appreciated the expertise you've been able to share with us throughout these programs, especially in recent years with so much happening on the international level, right? And when it comes to people coming to America, refugees coming to America, resettling here in Western New York, of course, and then major changes on the federal level since the change of administration earlier this year. Let's start right off with the administration, if you don't mind, because I know as we are recording here on September 30th, that you are waiting for a presidential determination when it comes to the number of refugees who may or may not be coming to the United States. Just give us a little background and what we could expect, I guess, or for lack of a better term, just what this really means, whether it was this year or any other year.
Absolutely. So what's called the PD, the presidential determination, is a ceiling that is set every year by the president for how many refugees will be allowed in for resettlement. Refugees for resettlement through a government program called USRAP, U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, which was set up in 1980 through statutory law that was passed. So every year that number is passed and set. Since we're at the end of September and it hasn't happened yet, it's going to be up in the air. No one will be coming in until that number is stated. We have heard from our national office that it looks like the Trump administration may allow in about 19,000 refugees this year.
19,000.
19,000. Yep. Which is quite frankly a bigger number than I anticipated, okay, given the last year. But understand it's a very small number because the last year was the PD had been set by President Biden and it was at 125,000. However, nowhere near that number was reached because the USRAP program itself was suspended by January 20th by executive order by President Trump. So we've been operating. We're still in a suspension land while that's being litigated now at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. In the meantime, the first Trump PD is supposed to be coming out. And what we have heard is that the 19,000 will be mostly comprised of South African refugees, the Afrikaner group, and Afghans primarily. And then there may be a small number of people who are allowed in through what's called the Pesito v. Trump litigation. That's the lawsuit that was filed about the suspension that happened on January 20th. So That's what we're waiting to hear. And we've received paperwork, according to this, that would fund us. But nothing's actually happened.
Okay. Let's put it into context, though, in terms of what we've seen in the past. You said President Biden's last determination was 125,000 refugees. This has been in place now for over four decades. How have the numbers varied through years?
Yeah, the ebbs and flows are so great to talk about. So thanks for asking, because I think it gives people more perspective on this program, which is secure and beneficial and an economic booster for the nation. And people don't realize it because it becomes conflated with other migration and immigration issues. The program was started in 1980 after the United States took international law and essentially adopted that language into our own national law. And it was passed with the 1980 Refugee Act. Okay. And so that, you know, in those first years in the 80s under Republican presidencies, I might add,
right,
220,000 was the admission ceiling at that time. I mean, 220,000, we haven't seen those numbers in recent years.
Sure.
So it started to go down to about 100,000. You know, in the more recent era, like the Obama years, it was around 80,000. I think under the first Bush, it was 60,000. It was somewhere in there. It was nowhere near at that peak of 200,000-ish.
Yep. But
it was the first Trump administration that took Obama's last number of 85,000 and took it all the way down to 40,000. And by the time he left office, it was 10,000. So when Biden came into office, it went way back up to 125,000. So you see this seesaw that's going on.
Sure.
And that impacts like local organizations like the International Institute, because, you know, that impacts the numbers that we're welcoming in and how many staff we employ to be able to do services.
Boy, you touched on so many things that we can get into questions about, and hopefully we'll be able to circle back. The one thing that I want to make sure that we stress, because every time you're here, I ask this question, and I don't know, I guess I'm always so stunned by this number that I find it hard to believe. I should probably write it down and enter it into a concrete. How many people are considered refugees on the globe right now?
There's over 40 million registered with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, but actually displaced individuals that are the UN recognizes is over 100 million people.
100 million people are displaced on the globe right now.
Correct. And that can be due to war, conflict, lack of resources, and also now climate change.
Yeah.
As literal land and homeland disappears because it's eroded due to climate change. So over 100 million people don't have a permanent home on this planet. And it's a problem because it's going to come with it accompanying problems of poverty and sickness and famine. And, you know, those are things that you can't just isolate, as some people would want to do. Like, that actually has to be addressed, because it's only going to continue to grow as an issue for all populations.
And I don't think I necessarily have to prod you too much on this, but the benefits of refugees in the United States and here in Buffalo, we've talked about this before, but it's always, I think, worth putting into perspective, you know, what have we seen in 40 plus years of this program, bringing refugees to the United States?
Yeah, I mean, this program was started largely with the aim of it being humanitarian, like it's the right thing to do. And that absolutely exists as a core tenet. But what I would say is that the surprising aspect that was tracked after 20 years was the amazing economic contribution that this program has brought. And they've actually studied it. You know, there's numbers to quantify it. For instance, they did a 15-year look at the resettlement program and looked at the amount of money invested in bringing people here and, you know, giving them money through case managers, the International Institute, food stamps, et cetera. And then they looked at their economic output through taxes and revenue growth. And they determined that there was $124 billion increase in net worth and net fiscal value from refugees over a 15-year period nationally. And when you look at that big number, that boils down to a place like Buffalo, which has had population decline documented for over 50 years, finally seeing a population uptick in 2020 in the census. That was attributed to the foreign born, and that's attributed to the fact that there are 20,000 plus refugees that have come to settle here over the last decade. I mean, you have sizable communities that are here now. The Burmese community is estimated to be anywhere from 7 to 10,000 individuals in our city. Yes. So we've benefited from it, and we're able to grow as an economy and as a city and as a region because we have people here to work those jobs and contribute to our economic output.
And adding to the economic equation here, like you said, humanitarians should be right at the center of that, but it's not always, when you get into these discussions, that's not always necessarily what people want to talk about. They want to talk about economics and the cost of having people here. Your agency, the International Institute, one of the things you do, you help people resettle. You're also trying to connect them with employment opportunities as well. What can you tell us about employment of foreign-born people here in Western New York? And I'm wondering if maybe there's a greater numbers when it comes to the United States.
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of employers in town that are looking to hire and are struggling to retain a workforce. And if you talk to like cleaning companies, for instance, they'll tell you that the turnover in their industry is at like 300%. And, you know, as an employer myself, I can tell you that that's really rough. You know, you hire somebody, you train them, and then they're gone, you know, and you're hiring again, and the cost of hiring is so expensive. So, you know, there's really good retention value with foreign-born individuals and specifically refugees.
Okay.
You know, and there are stats on that. I can't bring all of those to you, but, you know, the one cleaning company that we interviewed recently had talked about the fact that, you know, they were able to retain people for 2-3 years. And that just was unheard of for them in hiring like the local population. So if you take something like that and you're able and you're a company that's manufacturing widgets, okay, and you're on one shift a day and you want to grow to 2 shifts so you can increase your output dramatically, you need a reliable workforce to be able to do that. And you can get that in people who are here and willing to work hard and learn. And little aspects like they don't speak the language of English perfectly, that's not as big of a deal if they're able to follow directions and learn the key components of that job. English comes with time for adults, especially. And, you know, the International Institute can plug in and help with that. You know, we work with employers to do cultural competency trainings and teach them about the workforce that they've brought in. We can come on site and do specific ESL classes related to the vocab of your industry, the certain words that people need, you know. And then we also work with the newly placed clients who are new employees to make sure that they're supported in their employment journey. You know, these are people who are not owning a home yet. They're not owning a car yet. They're relying on the bus to get there or walking. What's it like when they usually bicycle to work? And now they can't because there's a lot of snow. And how are they going to get there? So we help to sort of get all that stuff started, and we're the glue. And then people move on through their journey and find success. And eventually they're able to buy a car and buy a house. So that's a big piece of it. You know, the Institute's got about 100 different employers that we actively worked with. And then I've run into people in the community that used to work with us and they no longer need us. We've kind of worked our way out of their need because they've had such a, I mean, like there's a welding company in town, for instance, that had hired several Burmese refugees from us. And they got to the point that they had such a great, successful, retained employee force that just from local referrals in from staff, they didn't need to use the Institute as their employer match anymore.
And when it comes to welding, I mean, it's not the turnover that you're talking about in cleaning, but it's a high turnover industry for sure. So that's quite a startling piece of information there for sure. Jennifer Rizzo Choi is our guest. Jennifer is the executive director of International Institute of Buffalo. You did touch upon this a little bit earlier, of course. The presidential determination of the number of refugees who come to the United States and who then therefore end up here in Western New York impacts your agency because it comes with funding for your agency. And of course, with no refugees coming into the United States or here into Western New York, that made for some tough changes, I think, with your agency, if I'm not mistaken. What can you tell us? What can you tell us about the International Institute today?
Yeah, unfortunately, we are about half the size that we used to be, if you go by headcounts and also really by budget line. We had to do a bunch of layoffs back in February after the Trump administration came in and an executive order was passed that that's suspended the resettlement program. You know, some of the other agencies in town also had layoffs as well. I've tried to mitigate the impact to both the staff and to clients and to keep a happy culture. And so we've let, as people have left on their own through attrition, plus a smaller layoff, we went from, I'd say we had 65 headcounts on election day, and we now have 33 today, with not many plans to grow. You know, we're fortunate that we're in New York State and there is state funding available for continued services for refugees and other populations with immigration status. So we have state funding that we can depend upon. And we do have an interpretation and translation business, which is a revenue generator for us. And not all nonprofits have like a small business in-house.
Right.
And so definitely want to make sure people are aware of that, that if you have a document you need translated, if you know, if you want to get the WBFO website translated into the languages spoken into Western New York, you can hire us to do that. And we can provide interpretation and translation in over 100 languages.
Well, that's a service that is worth noting for sure. At the same time, talking about fundraisers, October 15th, which might actually be tonight as this is airing, the Refugees of Comedy coming back. I think you guys did this last year, if I'm not mistaken.
This
right?
is our third annual.
Year. Okay.
Yes, it is. It's a great event. I know I'm biased in saying that,
yes.
but I've had lots of people tell me as well. It's a great event because it's unique. You know, this is not your typical gala rubber chicken dinner. I mean, I've been to Lovely, a lot of those, but this one's a fun night. You can come casually dressed as well, because okay. it's right here at your studios yes. at Buffalo Toronto
Where
Public
casual
Media.
Casual dress is mandatory, if you can't tell, yeah.
You can wear fancy stuff, too, if you want. It's on a soundstage, so it's whatever right. goes. But the point of the event is laughter and fundraising for a good cause. And we are super lucky that we have a radio alum from Western New York who's famous.
Yes.
Tom Tran is one of our comedians who comes in from L.A. He's also got a tie to the Institute. We served his family and resettled his family when he came as a Vietnamese refugee. And he does this to pay it back to us, which is... really pay it forward in a way is what he right. believes in. So the last 3 years he's come. This year he's bringing two comedian friends with him. He's bringing Corinna Yee, who is a Chinese immigrant, and Matt Kirshen, who is a British immigrant. And the theme of the humor is a lot of integration humor, like what it's like today being a foreign-born person, like adjusting to life in America and all the funny things that go with that.
And boy, obviously the great thing about comedy is the satirical element of the reflection on what's happening and sometimes very difficult issues. And, you know, last year in the midst of an election run up and now here with a new presidential administration, the national conversation when it comes to immigration and to refugees is changed dramatically. I don't want you to step out of your lane here when it comes to, you know, telling us about what we can expect from comics. But I mean, do you find that though, that there's a certain poignancy to the comedy, that great balance that the comics can do where they can take a serious topic and, you know, something that almost borders on the tragic and still find a way to make it funny, but yet give maybe just a little insight into learning something new. I mean, do you find that in these evenings?
I think you put that in a very eloquent manner. You know, I find myself listening to comedy a lot more now on a podcast, Netflix at night. I mean, it's better than watching some of the daily headlines, right? Mm-hmm. And you're right. Sometimes a joke sort of distills like the feeling of whatever's going on in the moment, right? And there's just a core of it that will just resonate with you. I think laughter is really important right now because it's one of those things that binds us together. I mean, it's healthy to laugh. It's uniting to laugh. We're a lot more alike than we are different. And it's a struggle these days because there's a lot of divisiveness. And there doesn't need to be. And I think an event like this shows you how so many things are relatable. You know, I grew up with a lot of odd Italian things that went on in our big, you know, family dinners on the weekends. And that's not a whole lot different from, you know, some of the funny stories you hear about Middle Eastern dinners or Vietnamese family dinners. And it's just a great time to reflect on who we are and all the great aspects that make up our families and our community. So I'd really encourage people to come to this. It's a great night of entertainment. This is not something you can normally get in Buffalo. These folks fly in from LA because they are nationally famous. They're on, you know, Netflix and right. Comedy Central and Laugh Factory and all those places. We also do have great international food served in your studio that night.
Yes, very good.
You know, from four or five spots around the world. So it's a great international selection. And we're also going to start this year off with a Congolese rumba band. The Sawa Sawa Band is going to be the pre-entertainment. So it's pretty awesome time. You can get tickets online, www.iibuffalo.org, and you can buy tickets there.
Okay, and that's in our studios here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media on Lower Terrace in downtown Buffalo, 6 until 9 on October 15th. And just one other thought about Tom Tran. You mentioned, of course, Vietnamese refugees. Also, Tom served his country as well, is a member of the U.S. Army as well. So
that's a great point to note, because a lot of foreign-born immigrants serve in our military. And in fact, as part of the military recruitment, they push the fact that you get U.S. citizenship faster if you serve in our military. We don't have a draft, Jay, and it's not easy to maintain a fighting force. And so a lot of people who are immigrants join the military and serve.
Jennifer, you have a way of picking up on my loose change here and making it into worth a lot more, for sure. But I appreciate the levity, of course. But we really do have a lot to get into here when it comes to the current state of immigration. We can use as the overall element here, though. Of course, the International Institute is focused on helping refugees resettle here in Western New York. What are we hearing? And we most certainly are hearing, when it comes to immigration and customs enforcement, ICE, about what's happening around the country. What are you hearing? Are you hearing from, your peers in other communities as well, what's happening? And what are you hearing maybe here in Western New York that's maybe not getting the spotlight that it should?
There's just an undercurrent of fear and people feeling like their life is different and they can't do things because they're worried about ICE. And I'm not just talking about, because I can hear the argument saying, well, good, they should be scared. And it's like, we're not talking about people who are out of status. I'm talking about people who Right. are citizens and have green cards and this is their home and they're afraid too. We got a panicked call from an employer last week that, somebody had called reporting seeing foreign looking people in their parking lot and was very worried about an ICE show up at their facility. And every single one of their employees, they'd recently done their, routine audit. Everyone is still within status. I mean, they've hired a lot of refugees. Refugees have a permanent immigration right. status. It leads to a green card and citizenship. But this sort of thought that somebody who doesn't look, I guess, typical, like a Caucasian American, may not belong here, that pervasive thought is what's causing a lot of fear in different communities. So this is not just, people on the street. It's employers, it's schools. I've spoken to school administrators and university officials who are grappling with how do they handle things on campus? How do they make their population feel safe and be prepared? And a lot of that goes to how the ICE enforcement actions are taking place right now. What we've read in the paper is that there's a mandate to arrest 3,000 people nationally a day. That's a pretty big number when you think about it. I don't know what that boils down to being the local quota, but mixed up in that is going to be people who were improperly arrested. If you're not going on, an investigated, targeted angle and you're picking people up, then what we've already seen in newspaper accounts is that there have been U.S. citizens who have been arrested because they don't look American. They're, I assume, looking a person of color.
Right.
There are green card holders who have been accidentally deported. Or there are people who are just trying to comply with the law. And they're in status and they're going in for their interview for citizenship and they have been detained. And what happens when there's an ICE enforcement action like that, even at a place like a courthouse, is that a waterfall of consequences happens. If someone gets detained, presumably they're not going home at night then. So their kid may not have someone there when they get home from school. Their job now has somebody not showing up. They may spend weeks in detention getting this sorted out, thousands of dollars on a lawyer, sending paperwork. They may end up losing their job in the process and or possibly deported, all with which could be a big misunderstanding. So it's been a very challenging time for anybody that feels that they're being touched by ICE actions.
And just to bring this up, at court hearings, people who are seeking asylum or have some other business in front of the federal court, and we've heard of these people being detained as well.
Yeah, and that's really a different tactic than had been done in the past. So, if you look online, you'll even see like prior administrators and, even the Bush administrations would talk about the conscious decision to not do enforcement actions at court proceedings, because what you want in a society is people that follow the law. You know,
right.
Posted speed limit is this. You want people following the speed limit. And so with court, they wanted people showing up to go through the process. And the thought had always been, if you had ICE officers there taking people into arrest, then people would stop adhering to the law. And so that tactic has changed, and enforcement actions are now happening, not just at immigration court, but like, as you said, at local court. You know, they're happening even at like USCIS interviews. And so, you know, that has a chilling effect. And it impacts like regular Americans, too. If you happen to be somebody who had a car accident and somebody hit you and you're at regular court and then somebody is involved in this and they don't show up, the witness is an immigrant and they're too afraid to go to court. Well, you've now lost that person who participates in your case. We've also heard from people who've lost business overall just because, you know, no one's coming into shop because they're afraid to leave their house. So it's just a very different place than it used to be. Our country, like than a year ago.
You're listening to What's Next from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. Now, Naila Ansari-Cotillo sits down with Layton Jones from Our Action City Buffalo and John Torrey, professor at Buffalo State University. They talk about the impact of the One Big Beautiful Bill and how it's affecting communities right here in Buffalo. The conversation looks at how the legislation touches race, immigration, and civil rights, and how it connects to issues like poverty, food insecurity, Medicaid cuts, and education. They also share ways to take action, from learning more about local government to contacting representatives and getting involved in community groups. It's all about accountability, awareness, and making sure every voice in Buffalo is heard.
We have this big, beautiful bill that recently passed.
Oof.
Woof, as Dr. Torrey says.
You said big, beautiful? I don't
big,
find
beautiful.
Any
That's
beauty.
A, right. Or disasters bill, depending on who you talk to, right? And this affects all of us on a local level and in a major way. Can you all speak a little bit to Layton's point? We have to educate the community about how these laws and policies impact us. You know, I know recently OCAP had did one on the charter. You know, we'll talk a little bit about that. Well, what can the mayor do? Who's supposed to come in places? All of those things with policies. But this is the same thing that's happening on a grand scale that affects everyone. So, Dr. Torrey, can you talk a little bit about what does this mean for us in terms of race and immigration and civil rights, and what concerns or hopes does it raise for you?
Hopes? None. Concerns? A ton. It doesn't look good in a lot of ways, not just with the large bill. We're seeing more attempts at the federal level and at the Supreme Court also. We're going to see a lot of assaults on the norms that we've come to assume to be regular over the last 30 or 40 years. A lot of those norms are going to get challenged and or pushed back. And this bill is just one more example of that. A number of the places and the people who need services and who need help, the poorest of us, those of us who are the least advantaged, those of us who could use the hand that could help stabilize their life, a lot of them are not going to have access to that hand. And that's going to chop access for employment and services inside of education, healthcare, mental health care. Those places alone are more than enough to help undermine the health of a society in all the wrong kinds of ways. And again, generally speaking, when bad hits, it hits the least of us the fastest. So,
and the way that it impacts us, just some quick facts, is we have a high poverty rate here in Buffalo, Western New York.
One of the biggest in the country.
One of the biggest in the country. Food insecurity, SNAP cuts that will happen. Medicaid restriction, immigration enforcement. It's a reverse Robin Hood, as some folks would say and call it. Layton, how do we protect ourselves?
How do we protect ourselves? One, we have to know what the big, beautiful bill represents. One of the things you just listed is that like poor or low income families will be directly impacted by this bill immediately. Mm-hmm. No questions about that. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that I'm also having is that this is going to like impact local hospitals, local community centers. Like if people can't get healthcare, how are they going to continue to survive, right? When we're talking about Medicaid cuts, if the hospital isn't able to provide this type of care anymore or to provide it to a certain class of people because they cannot afford it, how will we go forward? So one, I really want the its intention on residents is to be like educating themselves on what is happening and what is the process, then what you can do is go to your council member, go to your mayor and tell them, look, this isn't okay. And I need you to say that. So on a citywide level, on the in the grand scheme of things, we have representatives from New York State that are saying, this is unacceptable. This is not something that we can do. And then they can make a plan. They can make plans with Kathy Hochul. They can make plans with our governor of the state to like funnel more money into the city so we can ensure that we're not losing the resources that we currently have. Because if we lose them, how will we get them back? Right? It's one thing to have them, it's another to lose them. And that's one of the things that I would say people can do in this moment is to educate yourself, because the amount of things that are happening, the amount of moving parts, they're intentionally doing this so you can't keep up. So you feel overwhelmed, you feel burdened, you feel the pressure. And it's hard to sit in that hot seat. One of my friends say, like, we have mini fires happening everywhere, mm-hmm. and you're picking which ones you're going to put out, right? So like, let's do a little deep dive into what this policy means and go to like your local organizations like Our City Action Buffalo, Push Buffalo, New York Immigration Coalition, and get involved, because that's the only way you will be a part of a community that is making change.
To that end, I just want to make sure to point out your local representatives also include your state representatives. So you have state senators and you have state house reps, and they can also be just as, right, state assembly. Thank you. They are just as much of a part of the process to help try to push forward policy and finance to try to get the help and resources you need in the spaces that we need them. Because like you said, everyone who's going to need help is about to need that much more help soon.
And we also have to talk about folks in education. I know we're here, but we forget about that part of the bill. You know, that affects Pell Grants, particularly graduate student federal loans, professional students. Mm-hmm. We're looking at a wide range of reduced subsidized options for students as a whole, energy. So when we talk about the big, beautiful bill, we, you know, we tend to kind of get put on those big things that get put kind of out there on the news. But there are so many things in this bill that is going to affect everyone in what Dr. Jory says, not so hopeful ways.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for us to have these conversations, because when people don't know, they don't know.
Yeah.
And I think we always assume people know. And that's a problem, because when we go to the ballots, we're choosing a lot of times based off of just the party we are supposed to be connected to.
Or not necessarily,
or the name that we heard, or something that maybe gets publicized, but we don't really truly know what we're voting for. How do we connect local action to a global understanding of justice and human rights so Buffalo isn't just reacting, but we're leading?
So with that, I'm going to say like a quote that my mom told me before I came to the U.S. And she said, listen, son, Black people are not a minority, okay? We are the global majority. So put that into the back of your head always if you're a Black person or a person of color, because they want you to feel like you're a minority. And really, that's only out of fear, because they know you're big. They know how much power you have. And if you take control of that, the influence that you can have on a city is very broad. It's available. And it's necessary. So one of the issues that we're having in politics right now is that we feel, some people would say we have a king,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. Mm. And we have to understand that we, regardless of if we disagree with another one's opinion, we still have to come to this common place of having a conversation. I thrive in conversations of, I'm not the same as the other person, because I want to learn why you're saying this and intentionally have a conversation with you about how that's impacting not you, but people who may not look like you. And are you saying that I don't exist or I don't matter simply because of the fact that I'm not the same as you are? No, that's far from, sometimes that's far from what they're saying, and other times that's not. But for the most part, if you have the human capacity and the human encompassing mind to say that other people exist, you are on that. And that's one of the main things I want people to understand is that, like, regardless of your difference, you're human, you bleed. And so that's where you can find some commonality and move past any hate that is within your mind or within your mm-hmm. compass. But yeah, as of right now, on a national scale, we're like in an oligarchy situation. And how I want to connect that locally is that when we think about the oligarchs, we're thinking about Donald Trump, we're thinking about Elon Musk, we're thinking about all of those big top rich people. We also have that on a local scale, and we need to call that out, right? So initially, when this mayoral campaign started with the acting mayor, we saw that a lot of these developers were mm-hmm. donating to his campaign, right? You see that because they are the people that are essentially in charge. They are telling him what to do and how to do it and what policies they want to drive. And that's how they influence our economy. So when we see that happening, we're documenting who these big players are. And they are a part of the local oligarch. And when you target those people to see what policies they're pushing, you get to understand what politicians are involved in the interweeds of that and how to influence the community to get them out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that I think is a big part of maybe OCAB and Who Rules Buffalo. And we have, like, you know, an updated... We have an updated report.
Oh, you did an updated report.
Yes, that is going to be released in November post-election. But it's an updated report for post-election things, right? Initially, we talked about what the local power structure looks like. What does the current power structure look like? Who will be taking charge? And can we or can we not trust them? And why?
So we'll have you back in November to give that report. And then Dr. Tori will give us the entire breakdown of what that means.
Fantastic. I love being used for analysis. Put me to work. I love it.
Dr. Tori, do you think if we follow everything Layton is telling us we should be able to do here in Buffalo, do you think we can be a model for the nation on how we can localize the leadership here to be able to still fight against a bigger power nationally that's trying to work against our local policies?
The answer would be kinda, because mm-hmm. we're demographically we're unique. So we've got significantly more of an international flavor than most cities would get in general, and that most cities would give us credit for. We're also mid-sized, but not big, at least in terms of, like, inside the city. So like a city like Memphis is going to be about three times as big as us in terms of population, and about as person of color, so that's 2/3 black down there. So the ways in which we would have to navigate the coalition building that's getting done in order to have the kind of leadership we're looking for, I think that changes place to place. If anything, it might show a framework that you can then apply to your own location. You know what I'm saying? So you need to find your local leaders. You need to include a diverse population. You need to diffuse power instead of infuse it into one location. You need to hold your civic officials accountable. You need to have civic responsibility from your citizens to make sure everyone knows what their job is to do so that they can participate. I mean, again, as a framework, I think that's applicable wide scale. But how we do it here, the only other city in the state that could compare to us like this would be New York City. We couldn't use the same model. We could barely put a model like this on one of the boroughs, let alone all of them. Mm-hmm. All, however, 24 of them they got. Someone might try to hit me for saying this. Is it seven? It's seven?
It is seven.
Seven? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Seven. Yeah, all seven.
Ooh, see, they already don't want to put Buffalo part of it. It's like New York City and New York. So Buffalo, you know, they always try to separate us anyway. Don't mess up the boroughs, Western Dr. Tori.
Yes. But again, we all Western New York. Meanwhile, there's a whole bunch of cities out here that they forget about. But who's talking? As there was something that, Layton, that you mentioned that made me think of in terms of that local to global idea. Part of politics in general right now is a struggle to reconcile two things at once, which is that reasonable people can disagree
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
that the Baldwin quote is, what is it? My disagreement ends if it's rooted in my lack of humanity, right? Like, and this is, I think, one of the difficult parts, both locally and at a federal level and at a state level, we're going to find is trying to reconcile the fact that a fair number of the disagreements are about someone's humanity, someone's ability to be in some real regard. And
perhaps too many people are willing to consider that just disagreement as opposed to a discussion we can't have. Mm. And figuring out how to navigate that there's a discussion we can't have, but you want to have it. But we can't have that. Like, we're not talking about that because we're not going to let you be pressured to have someone have to justify that you exist. You're here. You're making a claim. You're here. I'll be curious to see what that model looks like for us locally, because that part, I do think that can get mapped out everywhere, because mm-hmm. everywhere's going to have a particular kind of diversity with this kind of, well, I don't think you should be here, but, well, I'm here and I'm trying to stay and I want to work it out with you so that we can do this together and everyone benefit. What does this look like? So figuring out that model, I think that certainly does port over.
Well, I mean, to respond to that a little bit and like put some humanity aspect into like specifically what ICE is doing, right? When you think about families getting ripped apart, when you think about people getting shipped to camp, right? When you think about like a mom getting deported and leaving a 5-year-old, that's things that are happening here,
right? Mm-hmm.
Right? And so what then happens to that child? Mm-hmm. And then our local leaders are unaware that that child is at home alone and their parent is gone with no one understanding where they are to begin mm-hmm. with, right? So like, that's a humanity aspect, right? When we think about trans people, they shouldn't exist. We should eradicate them. We should eradicate their services. There's no place for them in schools. There's no place for them in Olympics. There's no place for them where. They still exist regardless of that narrative.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We can't talk about people and not expect people to experience an emotion.
Right. And locally, we have to be the humanity, right? We have to be the model for everyone else to be able to say, we have humanity here and we want it to exist, and we want it to exist in a huge way and in a good way. I want to wrap up with you all today. So I might end with a difficult question for you all, but I think y'all can do it. What are three concrete things Buffalo can do right now to be safer, fairer, and more equitable?
Three concrete things.
Or give me one. Maybe three was... excessive. I
mean, do we have enough time? You said safer, fairer, and what?
And more equitable.
More equitable. Oh my God.
We'll have you go first.
Yeah. Well, keeping in mind the business about the school board, you're going to have to significantly impact and change how we're doing education. That's going to mean, what are we paying our teachers? It's going to mean, what are we doing with the school buildings? That's going to mean, what are we teaching our young people? And that's going to mean, what kind of defense are we putting around the wins that we've had and the protections that we require so that they can get, again, the kind of education we want? Because those same kids, they come out 5 to 15 years later, they're in the same world working with you and I. And we want them to be able to be happy, successful, wonderful people like we get to be because we benefited from some sort of a quality education. So I think that might knock in what you said, fair, equitable, and
safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my goodness, the more education you tend to find, the fewer crime you tend to see. And that tends to, I think, vary by zip code across the country. But my gut tells me, not my gut, but research tends to show, if you give young people something to do that has nothing to do with them being outside in places that they're not supposed to, quote unquote, be, they tend to find something to do that will benefit themselves. And there are a lot of ways to be outside. There are ways to be productive outside. But again, reinforcing the fact that we need to double down education, community centers, put resources in where you know people need to mm-hmm. be able to have, again, safety, shelter, and access. That I guess doing that in and of itself helps to make the city safer, fairer, and more equitable.
Absolutely.
Mm. While you were talking, I got to write down my thoughts, you know.
Layton is ready. Layton has all the answers.
Layton got the notepad.
Okay, for a more fair, educated, and organized Buffalo, what they can do right now is pre-order Who Rules Buffalo. Why? Because, right, look, we're going to frame Who Rules Buffalo as a campaign about holding the rich and powerful accountable, right? And for as long as we have existed, I mean, we have commissioned this report because if we're going to be strategic and run campaigns that get people or get our people what they need and deserve, we're going to have to know who the players are, what matters to them, and who their allies in city government is. And so understanding that and getting a concrete understanding of who actually rules Buffalo and not the local leaders who are representing these folks understanding that would help us to create like a fear construct in our mind that we don't have the same opportunities these people have because of how much money they have and how much influence they might have. That's fair. When we're talking about making it safer, let's talk about the Board of Education and ensure that we understand who's running and who we need to vote for, as well as the mayor, right? And we can also let them know what we want. They're still running a campaign. Mm-hmm. It's not over until it is. And so keep up until then, right? And even after that, still put the fire in their backs. They need to feel the heat to do something, evidently. And so that will make our city safer to have local leaders who are accountable and who we can trust. And the last thing is equitable. I spoke about the charter. The charter mm-hmm. revision is happening right now as we speak. There will be a meeting at least once a month, and they're setting the meetings for 5 p.m. in City Hall. And so what you can do is make sure that you're at that meeting. Understand who these commission people are, because most, if not all of them, have a JD. Most of them are lawyers. Most of them are of European descent. They aren't necessarily representing the diverse population or the Black population that has been the plurality of Buffalo for years. And so the only way you are going to have impact and let them understand what your experience is in this city, or to consider you in the rules leading this city in the next 25 years, you have to be there. Let's be a part of these processes. So that's how you can allow yourself to have an equitable city, because you'll be considered in the law.
Because this is our city.
Right.
Tag on Our City Action Buffalo.
That's not an endorsement. That's just a thumbs up.
That's it. Thank you, Leighton Jones and Dr. John Torrey, for being here and the work that you all are doing. To our listeners, the conversation doesn't end here. Stay informed, stay engaged, and remember that history is only erased when we allow it to be. I'm Naila Ansari Carbonell Cantillo, and this has been What's Next. Until next time, keep asking what's next for us.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.